Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 127 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarvox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And also the unofficial third member of the group is the Pimping Bell. Say hello, Pimping Bell. That is the sound of a new Pimping Bell. One of our listeners came up to us at the AAD and gave us a Pimping Bell that I can have. Don't remember your name 100%, but I think it was Lou Gagan. So thank you so much. So now I've got one on site in Salt Lake City. So if Michelle's rolling along her thought train, unavailable to also ring bells, then I can ring them for her.
It is kind of like dancing and talking or chewing gum and walking or something like that to ring the bell and be discussing the article at the same time. So I'm very grateful.
We're going to talk more about the AAD a little bit later, but speaking of our friends, we have become friends with the Integrative Dermatology Symposium, or IDS, who's got their symposium coming up later this year. So, are you ready to revolutionize your approach to dermatological care? Allow me to introduce the Integrative Dermatology Symposium, IDS, a groundbreaking four-day medical education conference that's redefining conventional limits. IDS is more than just an event. It's a transformative experience. Join the integrative dermatology community, fostering collaboration among healthcare professionals and bridging the gap between Western and Eastern modalities. Explore aging, wellness, and integrative aesthetics to develop a more comprehensive approach to patient care. IDS is all about embracing the power of collaboration in healthcare, infusing new ideas and treatment options into the discussion, and contributing to the evolution of whole person care, benefiting every patient. Mark your calendars now for IDS 2024, happening in Arlington, Texas, from September 26th to 29. This is your chance to be part of the future of dermatological care. Early bird pricing ends on April 19th. Listeners, you can use the code DERMASPHERE, D-E-R-M-A, sphere, for 25% off your registration. Woo. And speaking of our friends at IDS, we have one of them with us today. This is Dr. Steve Dave Louie. Dr. Dave Louie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Great.
I'm very good.
You.
Do you want to start just by introducing a little something about yourself?
Yes. So like Luke mentioned, I'm Steve Dave Louie. I'm an associate professor and program director at Wayne State University in lovely Detroit. I do medical derm there, especially complex medical derm, and I have a special interest in integrative dermatology, which is why I've worked on it and got involved with the Integrative Derm Symposium and worked my way up to being one of the co-chairs for this year's meeting, along with my good friend Hadar Levtov.
Yay!
Congratulations. And we thought we'd discuss something integrative and dermatologic today. And you provided this great article that's called Integrative Therapies for Warts and Molluscum Contagiosum. This is out of the Journal of Integrative Dermatology, published in June of 2022. Authors include Austin Wang and your friend and mine, Peter Leo.
Yes, yes. And I'm happy to talk about it. And I'm always happy to read articles that Peter Leo writes. He is a giant in the field of integrative dermatology and a leader. And he in this article really exemplify what I love about integrative dermatology that you mentioned in the intro, is that it's looking at these sort of complementary medicines and treatments, but looking at it through the lens we're used to, which is what's the evidence? You know, show me the proof, show me the studies that something works. So that way you can make evidence-based recommendations for things instead of it just being anecdotal. Oh, I heard this works. I heard, you know, duct tape works for your warts or tea tree oil. It's like, well, let's actually see what the evidence shows. And this article does a really good job of summarizing trials and case reports for these different treatments.
I admit I was skeptical when I was informed of the title of this article, but it's really good. And it talks about studies that have been published about these issues, including some randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials. The numbers are usually fairly small, but still, that's a pretty good way to go about doing a trial to see if something works. It starts with cantharidin, and I think we can probably skip that one since we now have the cantharidin device approval and bigger trials for that one that we discussed earlier on the podcast. So if you don't mind, Dr. Dave Louie, I'm hoping we can skip through that one and go right to the essential oils section, and maybe you can outline that one for us.
Absolutely. So the essential oils, they looked at lemon myrtle, and the article has the scientific names. I'm not even going to try to pronounce some of these scientific names for things, but it looks at lemon myrtle and tea tree oil and also East Indian sandalwood. And like you mentioned, some of these actually have randomized controlled trials, albeit with small numbers, 31 patients for the lemon myrtle. They put it on daily. It was a 10% concentration and 90% saw improvement. They saw a 90% improvement in about 56% of the patients by 3 weeks, which was good. And then tea tree oil also had a randomized controlled trial where they saw greater than or equal to 90% improvement in 84%. And in this case, in their trial, it was combined with iodine, which makes it a little different than someone just grabbing tea tree oil over the counter. And tea tree oil may be something that pops up in people's heads because you remember studying for allergic contact dermatitis and knowing that tea tree oil is one of the potential allergens. Yes, love it. but it actually is pretty widely used and the risk of contact allergy is relatively low. It just tends to be that that's where we interact with it because we see patients who are having an allergy to it. But if you get used to kind of utilizing it more, you can use it for things like warts and kind of use it in a safe way while still letting people know they could develop an allergy.
And the studies that you mentioned were for molluscum, right? So the lemon myrtle was, and then the tea tree oil, also molluscum. But then there's another study they talk about, which was for warts.
Right. Absolutely right. And that's the article does a good job of sort of breaking down which things were studied in molluscum, which in warts, and which were studied in both so that you can kind of keep it clear because even though a lot of the treatments probably would work for both, it's good to know what was this actually studied in, what age group was it studied in. So they break that down to kind of guide you in your treatment choices.
And this other study was using various concentrations of sandalwood oil, and after 12 weeks, significant improvement in the highest concentration of this sandalwood oil was 18% of people versus about 5% in placebo. So it seems like it's doing something, though 18% is not super impressive, but the essential oils studies that you mentioned earlier, those are kind of impressive. Do you use these in clinical practice? Like, is it routine for you to say, oh, by the way, we should use this lemon myrtle oil, or do you wait for people to ask about it? What's your approach?
So I use these things adjunctively to our typical wart treatments or molluscum treatments that we're doing in the office, like you mentioned, like cantharidin or liquid nitrogen, because patients like to have something to do at home. And sometimes we recommend salicylic acid, but a lot of times they've come in and sort of already tried that. Having said that, I always review how they're using it because often there's room for improvement in how people are using their at-home salicylic acid. But the tea tree oil is one that I recommend somewhat frequently. And one of the reasons is because everybody knows how to find tea tree oil. It's widely available, easy to find. I do warn them that this is the one time that we do tell patients they can apply tea tree oil directly to their skin. Typically, we don't want to because it can be irritating or higher risk of contact allergy. But when it comes to warts and molluscum, that might actually be a little bit beneficial to catch the immune system's attention and maybe it'll identify the virus. So I do tell them if they want to apply tea tree oil, I usually tell them to start by doing it between visits, just do it once and then wait a few days just to make sure they don't have any sort of strong reaction to it. I usually say don't put it under a Band-Aid or anything, just let it dry up. And then they can sort of adjust based on how that goes. If they're not getting a lot of irritation or inflammation, they can work their way up to daily and maybe even daily under a bandage. But I sort of ease into it. Usually I'm seeing my wart patients back every 2 to 3 weeks to retreat in the office. So I can kind of walk them through. If I get that vibe that it's easier to keep it simple, I'll just say, well, just try it a couple times before I see you back and then we'll talk again.
Do you have particular products that you like to recommend?
I usually just tell them to get the pure essential oil tea tree oil. That is one thing that's tricky with tea tree oil is there's a lot of products that contain it. But the essential oils are pretty widely available now, like even some grocery stores and things will sell them. So I say get just the essential oil tea tree oil, not like a tea tree oil shampoo or some other product that contains it. And then I make sure to tell them to keep the cap on when you're not using it. Keep it out of sunlight. Keep it away from heat, because when it oxidizes is when it actually becomes more allergenic. So I say, like, don't keep this one in the bathroom where the temperature goes up higher when you're taking your hot shower, which I also recommend people don't do.
All right. The next section is about oral medication, or I guess oral supplements, oral propolis and echinacea. I didn't even know propolis was something you could take by mouth. I know that bees make it, and then it's in like chapsticks and stuff, and it's another sensitizer, but that was the extent of my knowledge.
Me too. I had never heard of taking oral propolis before. I'd only heard about it in topicals. So this is kind of interesting. And I wondered, could you tell people just like eat some honeycomb and get a lot of the, not the cereal, but the actual bee's honeycomb. But yeah, they did see in some complete clearance in people taking propolis 500 milligrams a day. 73% of people with common warts had complete clearance, 75% for flat warts, and 17% for plantar warts. So it seemed to work a little better, but I mean, plantar warts are always the trickiest one. They did include in the paper that there's a warning that if you take more than 15 grams of propolis a day, you get an increased risk of allergic reactions and skin and mucous membrane irritation. So luckily these doses are much smaller at 500 milligrams a day, but still something to just be conscious of, because every once in a while you get the patient who goes, well, if some is good, then more is better.
Yeah, that's the American philosophy that we have to worry about sometimes, about when we're recommending things that don't have hard lines around dosage. But I absolutely agree with you. It's a very interesting substance, has some anti-inflammatory properties. My twin sister is an opera singer, and the opera singers actually use propolis spray for their vocal cords.
Oh, that's really interesting. All the amazing things bees give us, right?
We got to
save the bees.
Yes, we do.
If we lost them, it would really sting. So I think some of these numbers are fairly impressive. 3 months, 75% of your flat warts are gone. I sometimes don't achieve that if I am freezing them every 4 weeks. So it's reasonable to do, it seems like. Again, fairly small trial, 135 patients. But the stuff is cheap. It's like $10 for a big old bottle of it. And as far as I can tell, there's not a lot of concern unless you take 30 capsules in a day.
Exactly. And they did include as another group in the study, echinacea 600 milligrams a day, and it didn't do as well. It was like 20% of common warts, 36% of flat warts, and none of the plantar warts. So that's what I took away too, that this propolis might be a good add-on with relatively very few risk of side effects and maybe a benefit.
What would the dose be in a pediatric patient, I wonder?
That is a very good question. I'm going to have to go back to the literature and see if it's been used for pediatrics and if anybody has sort of defined a dose.
My usual approach is to assume an adult dose for a 70 kilogram human and then like just do the math. So if they're 35 kilograms, have them take 250 milligrams a day. But, you know, there's not like data behind that. There's like quasi science, but still, I certainly have pediatric patients with recalcitrant warts, and I think this would be appealing to their parents. Sometimes I go to cimetidine if all else fails, because we know there's like very minimal data, but I've had one or two patients where it really did seem to be the miracle cure after everything else failed. So maybe this is something else we can think about in that realm.
And that's what's funny with warts, right? Is you get those really recalcitrant ones where you're kind of running through every option you have and happy to have anything added to the arsenal for those just terrible warts that seem to just be resistant to everything you try.
All right, let's move on to talk about heat. So they talk about heat patches and targeted devices. Have you ever used any of these, Dr. Dave Louis?
I have not used any of the heat devices or even the targeted patches. Interestingly, at one of our clinics, it's actually at our VA clinic, they just got one of the devices in podiatry. So I just had a training session yesterday on one of the, I think it's a microwave-based device and how to use it to treat warts. And the numbers looked pretty impressive for their clearance. Granted, this is the information being shared during a training session by the company who made the device, so take it with a grain of salt. But it's kind of interesting because these therapies don't really need the immune system as much. So some of the case reports of using these different things were in organ transplant patients who we know can get worse warts or more warts because their immune system's just kind of letting the virus in. But you're also being more careful about what treatments you give, just in light of their immunosuppression, and you want to avoid drug-drug interactions with certain things. So these devices are kind of a nice alternative. We're used to freezing warts. Well, what about heating them up? But it's mostly case series for these, which isn't the strongest data out there. And then there's a lot of heterogeneity in, you know, the device that's used, the temperature that it's heated to. So I think this is an area where we're going to see more interest in the future and more devices sort of doing more controlled trials to really show that they have a benefit. So I think it might be something that becomes a little more commonplace.
What's the name of the device that you guys have?
Oh my gosh. What is Swift? The Swift device.
All right. Well, look up and see how much it costs while you guys talk about zinc.
The Swift wart treatment. Yes, zinc, an old medicine, but a goodie. What kind of things are zinc being used for?
So zinc, like you said, it's been around a long time. We need zinc. And it has these interesting sort of immunomodulatory effects where it's not going to suppress your immune system, but it's going to help it maybe with fighting some viruses. So there's been a couple studies of zinc that were three trials, and in total 68 patients. So again, not huge numbers, and this is for oral zinc. And the dose was usually around 10 mgs per kg of elemental zinc, which if you've, you know, there's zinc sulfate, zinc gluconate, but they have these converting things you can find online to say, all right, how much elemental zinc is in each one? So you can kind of work between them and prescribe whichever one you want, or not prescribe, recommend. And they did see across the three trials a clearance rate for warts between 53.8 to 86.9%. And that was over like a 2-month period in kids who were at least 4 years old. So this helps with some of our peds patients to give us an option. And it's, again, something that's pretty safe, relatively harmless. The one thing you got to watch with oral zinc is that it competes with copper binding sites. So if you supplement zinc for, for more than couple of months, you want to add on some copper at like a 10 zinc to one copper ratio.
There are some supplements that combine them. So there's like 10 milligram zinc, 1 milligram copper that is just more convenient. I recommend it for my hidradenitis suppurativa patients, for example.
Yes. Yeah. It's way more convenient when they're just all in one.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And then there's some discussion in this article also about hypnosis for warts. So that's kind of fascinating. What are your thoughts on that?
So I love this one. And when I first heard about hypnosis for warts, the speaker referenced in Huckleberry Finn, there's this wart remedy where it has something to do with like throwing a black cat over an open grave at when the moon is full. And it sort of just speaks to that power of suggestion. Mm-hmm. So I sometimes sort of use hypnosis. I'm not a hypnotherapist, so I don't use true hypnosis. But for my real little kiddos who are maybe like 5 and below, sometimes in the clinic, I'll have them draw a picture of your warts and now crumble it up and throw it in the garbage. And I tell them that makes your warts go away. And because,
oh, I love that.
Right? And it's fun. They can just do it on the exam paper with if I just hand them my pen or a crayon. And it's kind of fun. And I haven't studied it to see, but I feel like it's somewhat helpful and totally harmless. Then the other thing I do is there's this sort of field related to hypnosis called neuro-linguistic programming, where it's just sort of paying attention to the words you use. So I found after I learned about it that I tended to sort of be negative, like, oh, warts can be hard. It might take a lot of treatments. You know, we might see each other a lot. Now I still kind of let people know, all right, you know, sometimes it takes more than one treatment, but I also tell them we have evidence that if you believe your warts will go away, then there's a better chance that they will. So go ahead and believe that this is going to work and focus on my treatment, getting in that wart and your immune system attacking that wart. And that can help out. And that one of the studies, it was just a case series, did guided imagery of it, picturing your immune system going and attacking your wart as a form of hypnosis.
That's awesome. I really love that idea. Like whenever I'm treating warts with kids, especially if we're doing anything uncomfortable, sometimes I'll have them talk to the warts. I'll tell them, you tell that wart, go away, wart. And then they get focused on talking to the wart, like, yeah, go away, wart. And then you know, you can kind of engage their sort of fun side and trying to get them involved with that. That's awesome. I also had a pediatrician that trained me when I was in medical school, and she would actually talk to the wards, like for the kids. She'd be like, "You're going to leave this little kid alone." And it was like very interesting to see.
Right. And I mean, it can't hurt. And if anything, power of suggestion, it can be helpful. You know, the placebo effect, if you can harness it and take advantage of it, why not?
Maybe I should have like a little tiny magic wand that I pull out for kids in their warts. And I'm like, this is my magic wart wand. We're going to do some other stuff too, but this is the finishing touch. Poof, it'll go away.
I love it. And kids
then I can
would
sell
love
them
it.
For $100 each.
Right?
Speaking of cost for medical devices, that Swift device is about $10,000. So please be confident before you purchase one for your clinic.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us here, Steve. That's probably all the time we've got, but what a good article. I think the way I'll mostly use it is go back through it and create like an after-visit summary for my patients who might be interested in this stuff and just list out the stuff that I think is most helpful, like propolis, 500 milligrams a day, tea tree oil, the lemon myrtle oil, that kind of stuff if they want to try it.
Yeah, that's a great way to give patients that sort of take home remedies you can try that have some evidence.
I love that.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us, Steve. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners while we've got you here?
Thanks so much for having me. This was great. And if you're interested in learning more about integrative dermatology and seeing the evidence behind supplements, dietary changes, mental health interventions, join us at the IDS. We'd love to see you there.
I'll be there too.
Well, speaking of meetings, Michelle, you and I just came back from the AAD meeting in San Diego.
Whew, it was busy.
It was busy. And we had a lot of our listeners come up and say hello and tell us that they liked the podcast. So thanks very much. That really does mean a lot. A lot of the times we're just hanging out in our closets, talking to the microphones, and it's nice to know that sometimes we actually connect with some people. So thanks to the people who came up and said hello. And thanks again for the pimping bell gift. It's right
absolutely
here. So I wanted to make sure that we hit some of the highlights that we found from the AAD. So I'm going to go first here. Michelle, I don't know. You may have been too busy to find any highlights, but here are some pearls, just shotgunning it out there. So first, I went to the pre-AAD pediatric dermatology meeting. There was a session on shared decision making that I thought had a few useful phrases that you could use when you're talking to your patients and their families, such as, there are many reasonable options here. Let's work together to come up with a decision that's right for you. And let's start by exploring your specific goals and concerns. As you think about these options, what's important to you? Another little pearl was that the age of assent in the USA is 8 years old. That means if you're 8 years old or greater, even if your parents want you to do something, you don't have to say yes. Apparently, kids of that age have, quote, veto power. A diagnosis that's probably underrecognized, at least in the dermatology world, is called delayed subaponeurotic fluid collection. This presents in little babies, often like newborn types, as a squishy bag of water kind of nodule on the scalp that you can kind of just squish all over their head, but it can show up anywhere up to age 11 months. You want to make sure it's not blood. You don't want this child to be bleeding. You can do that with ultrasound or with maybe transilluminating it. It just spontaneously resolves over months. Nobody really knows why it happens, but you can reassure parents about that one. And then there was a case reported of, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Riga Fede disease or Riga Feed disease.
Ah, yes.
What's that, Michelle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exciting.
It's a reactive traumatic granuloma of the oral mucosa that's secondary to repeated friction, often against teeth. But there was this case of a little baby who had like natal teeth and eroded their entire bottom lip away, basically. It can be associated with insensitivity to pain syndromes. You might guess, you know, child chewing on it. This particular baby didn't have that, but the parents had been using an anesthetic, like mouth rinse for teething, and so probably it like numbed the lip, and the baby just chewed through it. Terrifying.
Oh my goodness.
But
yikes.
Shockingly, after those natal teeth were removed, the lip like completely regenerated. It looks better than it would have with a surgical repair, I think. So baby skin, pretty amazing. All right. Into the AAD. So we talked about warts and molluscum. So systemic retinoids like acitretin can help with warts, especially if combined with immunotherapy like candida antigen stuff. Again, we're just talking about all kinds of stuff here. Bullous pemphigoid. If the patient has elevated IgE or eosinophilia, you might consider treatment with omalizumab. Tapinarof, new psoriasis topical, is associated with folliculitis in a surprising number of patients, 20%. We probably discussed that when we went over the trials, but that was a little pearl. I usually use roflumilast instead. It's cheaper. People seem to like it. But still, tapinarof has a place. If you are a dermatopathologist...
The trade name for tapinarof is Vtama. I think sometimes like connecting those is important. And Vtama also can be associated with contact dermatitis. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Luke.
Well, are you a dermatopathologist?
In fact, yes, I am.
Well, you might be interested to know that apparently there's a new appropriate use criteria app for dermatopathologists to decide if they should be doing special stains and immunostains and stuff. Kind of like we've got one for Mohs. Mm-hmm. We talked about this once before, I get, I think maybe from the AAD last year, but it turns out that women, any women out there? Well, you guys have a particular RNA in your cells, which is called Xist. Capital X, little IST. And it's related to the inactivation of your X chromosomes, ladies. Mm-hmm. If you add Xist to male mice, they get lupus.
Huh.
And this might explain why women are much more prone to autoimmune disease than men. So they might develop autoantibodies to Xist and then via epitope spreading could attack other parts of their body.
The lionization process is interesting also. It spares TLR7. So that's on the X chromosome, but it resists lionization. And so that might be also one of the reasons why women tend to have a little more likelihood of having autoimmune disease, but also maybe the man cold is real.
The man cold is real. dupilumab. Apparently, you're not supposed to get live vaccines when you're on dupilumab, though I'll admit I wasn't aware of that. The recommendation is just because we don't have data that says it's safe, not because there's data that says it is unsafe. The speaker recommended you could consider stopping 2 weeks ahead of time, get the vaccine, wait for 4 weeks, start your dupilumab. But if the patient's really terrible, it's probably okay to also get the vaccines. 400 microns is the largest skin injury you can make without creating a scar.
Intriguing.
And so there are new micro-coring devices that cut out little tiny 400 micron chunks of your skin to improve like wrinkles and acne scars and things.
Intriguing.
Subcutaneous lupus erythematosus, SCLE. 25% of it is apparently triggered by drugs. The most common are antihypertensive, terbinafine, and proton pump inhibitors, so look for those. A lot of people with lupus have EBNA1 antibodies. And EBNA1 is an EBV-related antibody. Mm-hmm. So perhaps EBV in a genetically predisposed individual could be the trigger that leads to lupus. Patients with lupus who smoke have a hard time getting off their immunosuppressant medications compared to those who don't smoke. So I know smoking was bad in lupus, but now I think this is an extra tool to say, well, if you stop smoking, we might be able to get you off these pills that you don't like and have side effects.
Mm-hmm.
JAK inhibitors seem to work for various types of lupus, at least based on case reports. By the way, talked about a lot of articles in the AAD and probably will be discussing them over the course of the next year or so as well as things come up. Dupilumab can treat bullous pemphigoid, even that induced by anti-neoplastic agents. So I think we've seen like patients on nivolumab get bullous pemphigoid. You can treat that with dupilumab, turns out. And there are case reports of pediatric linear IgA bullous dermatosis, also treated successfully with dupilumab. PDL can be a treatment for acne. Didn't know that. I usually go to PDT if the patient's like can't tolerate isotretinoin and has bad acne, but you can consider PDL as well. There was a great cost-effectiveness discussion. So phototherapy for psoriasis, for example, is roughly comparable in efficacy to adalimumab, decreased risk of infection compared to biologics. So there's one study where in secukinumab-treated patients, 14% got an infection versus 0% on phototherapy. Phototherapy may also improve cardiovascular outcomes, so it seems like a pretty cost-effective choice. Sometimes it's hard to get for your patients, of course. Remember to check for tuberculosis before starting a biologic. If you think your patient has psoriatic arthritis, you want to ask them about stiffness, swelling, and pain that gets better with activity. And I don't know how to do like a psoriatic arthritis exam, but the speaker said that you should examine the small joints on the hand. Press hard enough, quote, so that the top third of your thumb becomes white. If the patient winces and pulls back, that could be inflammatory joint disease. Though check the elbow as well. If they do that there, then probably they have fibromyalgia. She recommended to check x-rays of the affected joints. And when you check labs, you want to check inflammatory markers like ESR and CRP and also uric acid, because you don't want the patient to actually have gout rather than psoriatic arthritis and you not recognize it. This speaker also recommended that in terms of the cardiovascular risks associated with psoriasis, you want to consider checking their blood pressure, check their lipids every 3 years, check their hemoglobin A1C every 5 years, tell them to stop smoking. Those are things that I usually expect their PCP to do, but some patients just like don't follow up with their PCP. So I suppose we could do it too. Acne. One of my dermatology heroes, Dr. John Barbieri, gave a great talk about this cost effectiveness in acne. So here's some thoughts. Per GoodRx, doxycycline, the like delayed release kind of thing, doxycycline MR is cheaper than I thought, $27 a month. But low-dose antibiotics may still create bacterial resistance, so don't think you're necessarily getting away with that. Generic combination products, generic ones, like adapalene and benzoyl peroxide together, are often efficacious and cost-effective, but the branded ones probably are really expensive. Triferritin is a new like retinoid lotion. It is more effective than existing topicals, but there are more adverse effects and it's way more expensive. $650 for a 45-gram tube. Topical clascoterone is a topical anti-androgen. It's approved for both women and men, but it's expensive, $560. But it does work
Winlevy,
well.
Winlevy, right?
Yeah,
is
that's
it Winlevy?
Right. Winlevy. Mm-hmm. It's equivalent to a topical retinoid in terms of efficacy, and it's extremely well tolerated, even better than its vehicle, strangely.
That is
so
weird.
Potentially an option if you can get it, but again, expensive. Patients who have been taking antibiotics for acne over months have their microbiome affected. There's an increase in gram negatives and in strep, potentially explaining the development of gram negative folliculitis and the association with strep pharyngitis. And there's a quote, try to limit the number of patients on antibiotics rather than the duration of antibiotics, because changes in the microbiome can be seen in as little as 4 weeks. There's a medicine out there called sarecycline. I think we maybe talked about the trials one of our very early episodes. It's extremely expensive, but it's probably more selective for the bacteria that we want to target with less effect on the microbiome. And it may be an acceptable choice for patients with limited options who need something long term. I can think of a patient or two of mine who have like this chronic scalp folliculitis that's just like not getting better and they can't tolerate minocycline or doxycycline or isotretinoin. Like, what are you going to do? Maybe sarecycline. Spironolactone. Compared to placebo, there was no increased risk of menstrual irregularities. I always tell people you might get spotted
that's
between
surprising.
Periods. Apparently not. Also, no increased polyuria. They don't pee more. No increased dizziness. This is things I tell people about, but there was a little bit of an increased risk of headaches. So maybe I don't have to tell them that they're going to have spotting in between periods. Maybe it's the nocebo effect. Hidradenitis suppurativa. Punch de-roofing seems like a pretty good idea. Use a punch instrument. You cut a hole in their nodule. You scrape it with a curette. Don't pack it, but gel foam is fine. There was some discussion about like what kind of dressings to use. These poor patients have like a lot of drainage from a lot of their areas. Maxi pads were brought up a couple times as an inexpensive option you can buy in bulk. Also, apparently a patient with hidradenitis suppurativa has invented particular clothes that you can put on that kind of hold the dressings in place. It's called HydraWear. We talked before about using rifampin plus clindamycin for hidradenitis suppurativa, but apparently the studies haven't been very good, so people are just using clindamycin as monotherapy instead. An important little tidbit is that the medications like adalimumab that are approved for hidradenitis suppurativa are approved for, quote, moderate to severe disease, not necessarily for specific early stages. So the clinician gets to decide what counts as moderate. Based on patient's pain or quality of life, for example. There's also a hidradenitis suppurativa like IGA score, where if they have 5 inflammatory nodules, that counts as moderate. So if you don't think your patient has scarring, so they don't have early stage 2 disease, but you still think they're like moderate disease, you can still call it that and hopefully get their medications approved by insurance. There's a lot more stuff I got from the AAD. Hopefully we'll talk about it in some articles that will come up here, but taking up enough time, I think, for now.
That's awesome. That was a great review, Luke.
Anything cool. You want to talk about that you learned from the AAD, or were you too busy giving the talks?
I was giving the talks, but some of the things that I think are good to bring forward, one of the points I always like to make, if you have a patient with neurofibromatosis type 1, they have an increased risk of many malignancies, especially for female patients under the age of 50. They actually have a fivefold increase in their breast cancer risk, and they have an increased risk for double negative or triple negative breast cancer. And so because of that, it is actually recommended that they get a breast MRI every year under age 20, after age 25. So after a female patient with neurofibromatosis type 1 reaches the age of 25, she should have a breast MRI every year because of the increased risk of breast cancer. I also had a case I presented of rheumatic fever, which is something we don't see that often as dermatologists, but we may be called to the fore with. And one of the interesting things about that is you're actually supposed to prophylax against recurrence of that rheumatic fever by protecting against the strep bacteria with antibiotic prophylaxis for 10 years if there's valvular disease, because it's compounding. So if the patient gets another episode of the rheumatic fever, which they're already predisposed to, it can cause compounded valvular damage. So like they either recommend 10 years or until the patient reaches the age of 21, which I think is one of those things that, you know, outside of the world of cardiology, you might not be aware of. I had a very fun session on infectious diseases, and I did dermoscopy of infectious diseases. And one of the points that I made during that talk was that splinters on the bottom of the foot can present actually as a pigmented lesion, because you can get a hemorrhage. It actually presents usually with parallel ridge pattern. And I also demonstrated that the splinters often have fungal organisms in them. So you can have the presence of fungal hyphae. The fungus that I actually was demonstrating in one of mine was actually the one that causes chromo and phaeohyphomycosis, which is how patients get phaeohyphomycotic cysts. Usually they have implantation traumatically of plant matter that's contaminated with the fungus. So removing splinters, if possible, is always a good idea. And we had a fun discussion over nipple adenomas and their pathologic and clinical simulants. And the fact that if you do have a patient that has a nipple adenoma, even though nipple adenomas themselves are benign, those patients do have an increased risk of breast cancer, and so they should have appropriate screening.
Something else that came up at slash right before the AAD was this business with benzoyl peroxide. Michelle, have you ever recommended that one of your patients with acne use benzoyl peroxide?
Gasp. Yes, I have, of course.
Also, like hidradenitis suppurativa, folliculitis, we use it for quite a few things. And like the Thursday before the AAD started, apparently, this company called Valisure filed a citizen's petition with the FDA to look into this finding that Valisure discovered, which was that benzoyl peroxide products can break down into benzene. So the story here is that Valisure is an LLC, and they refer to themselves as an independent lab, and they've got this track record of grabbing consumer products off the shelf and looking to see if they can find benzene in them, which is bad if you find it, because benzene is a known carcinogen. So if there's benzene in your products, like, that's a real thing that has to be taken seriously. And they had previously found benzene in a few other things like sunscreens and hand sanitizers, but it was thought to be contaminants from the manufacturing process. In this case, the benzoyl peroxide molecule can break down into benzene. So this company took like almost 100 products intended for acne treatment off of the shelves and tested them, and they found a little bit of benzene in them just taking them off the shelves. But then they cooked these products at 50 degrees Celsius, which is 122 degrees Fahrenheit, for 18 days and found that much, much more benzene was created. Like the normal upper limit that the FDA says might be considered safe is 2 parts per million. There were some products that had like 1500, so way more benzene. And they then filed this petition to say, hey, something should be done about this.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little bit more going on under the hood. And again, thanks to Dr. Barbieri, who talked about this at his acne talk. So perhaps one of the most important things is that Valisure has filed a patent on a molecule for a shelf-stable benzoyl peroxide. So there's a pretty significant conflict of interest there. And again, this is an LLC. It's not like a nonprofit organization that's out there for the good of humankind. They're trying to make money. But if they find that what we currently have could cause cancer in people and they come up with a non-cancer causing version, you know, that's all right. But still, that's significant, I think. Also, does cooking a product at 122 degrees for 18 days represent real-world usage? I think
if you leave it in your car in West Texas, yes. But, you know, I think for most people, probably no.
I think not. But I think that perhaps this heat could almost be a surrogate for time. Just kind of speeds up this natural process that's happening of benzoyl peroxide molecules breaking down into benzene. And if that happens in 18 days at 50 degrees Celsius at normal room temperature, maybe it would take, I don't know, 6 months, 2 years, something like that. So I think it does make sense to tell your patients if they've got some old benzoyl peroxide lying around from a prescription they got 2 years ago, then it's probably time to swap that out. But I think for most people, using it under normal circumstances where they go through a tube of their cleanser in like a month or two, you're probably fine. Also, they listed some of the products that had like the highest concentration of benzene formed. And they were all creams and gels and stuff. None of them were cleansers. And I usually recommend my patients use their products as cleansers. So I guess that's kind of reassuring. So probably we just need a little bit more data out of here. It would be nice to know the few products that didn't have benzene right off the shelf. It would also be nice to see what happens at sort of normal usage. Also, perhaps companies will add antioxidants or something to help improve the stability. It looks like that can happen. So this is what I would tell patients if, you know, if they know this. And if they are concerned about it and want to use an alternative, well, we do have some alternative topical acne medications. Of course, there's salicylic acid. There's a chlorine dioxide cleanser you can use. Apparently, there's a brand Aseptic MD. You can use a dilute sodium hypochlorite solution. There's a brand called CLN. You could use azelaic acid as well. There are alternatives, though. I do like benzoyl peroxide. And I also hate colored towels. So those two go together hand in hand.
I love that.
Michelle, do you have any other read on this issue?
You know, I think that it's one of those things that it's good for us to be aware of. I think that sometimes attention needs to be drawn to invisible sources of both concern and potentially contamination for skincare products. We do need to think about what we put on our skin and how it can affect our bodies. I think that benzoyl peroxide-based cleansers stored appropriately are very safe. Especially because this is a limited skin contact application. I think that cognizance about how we keep skincare products is important. You know, I used to keep my like sunscreens in my car, which, you know, over the time I've come to understand doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because some of these products could be thermolabile and you might have decreased efficacy of your sunscreens. You might have the inadvertent augmentation of maybe byproducts or things like that. So you can concentrate it because the water can evaporate. So I think storing skincare products responsibly is very reasonable. I'm interested to see how this kind of plays out now that there's the knowledge and awareness of the potential for the benzene in the topicals. I think that it's probably in a lot of products that are manufactured for human use, including drink additives, topical skincare products, all sorts of things. So as we pay better attention to how we have modified the environment as humans, we can take better care of ourselves and our colleagues and our patients. But I'm interested to see what happens.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Well, let's move on to more traditional article. Kind of do our normal thing here for the last 20 minutes or so.
All right. So I'm going to talk about some acute localized exanthematous pustulosis. Does that sound good to you?
That sounds great to me.
Fabulous. So we have a review article here out of Dermatologic Therapy. This is from November of 2020, and it is discussing acute localized exanthematous pustulosis, clinical features, pathophysiology, and therapy. The chief authors are Aiduri Safa and Jemaleddin Zilli, and they are out of the Department of Dermatology in Montsir, Tunisia, which is very cool. Actually, Tunisia is a beautiful country. The ALEP is a disease that is characterized by the acute onset of multiple localized non-follicular pinhead-sized pustules, and it's considered to be a localized form of acute generalized exanthematous pustulosis. So we're all pretty familiar with AGEP. Now we're going to learn about ALEP. So just a localized form of basically AGEP. So the authors did a systematic review of the literature, and they sort of summarized their findings. It is an uncommon condition. It's usually attributed to a hypersensitivity reaction, most commonly to a systemic drug. Similarly to AGEP, usually these are going to be beta-lactam antibiotics, but other drugs have been implicated, including herbal medications. Contact mechanisms have been reported as well. This condition can be misdiagnosed as infectious or inflammatory disease. A little plaque full of pustules could very easily be concerning for an infectious condition. But the clinical pathologic correlation, which is one of my favorite things in dermatology, I think that it is one of our superpowers as dermatologists to be able to provide clinical pathologic correlation, because ours is one of the very few specialties where pathology is a very big part of our education. And I think every dermatologist speaks a little dermpath, and that really helps us to understand why our conditions are presenting the way that they do, how they interact with our therapies, and potentially why they might appear atypical under certain circumstances. Rapid responses to withdrawal of the causative agent is typical of ALEP as it is of AGEP. And the pathogenesis of ALEP is still unclear as it is for AGEP. There's no standard treatment guidelines to manage this condition, but it is an important thing to be aware of. So I don't know if you knew that AGEP was first described in 1980 by Belot et al., a rare and severe drug-induced cutaneous eruption. The real cause of this, the pathophysiology, is still not completely elucidated. In 2005, Prang et al. Attributed the name of acute localized exanthematous pustulosis, ALEP, to the cases of AGEP where the lesions were confined to limited areas. And in these circumstances, the patients would meet the criteria for AGEP, but the lesions were just localized. ALEP tends to present more commonly on the face than anywhere else, which is one of the reasons I think it can be misdiagnosed as an infectious etiology. And it can be triggered by the same antibiotics that can cause AGEP. In their review of the literature, they found 21 articles that had 38 reported cases of ALEP, so it's still something that's probably underreported in the literature. There was a female predominance, and the mean range of age was 38 years of age, ranging from 9 to 78 in the reported cases. Most of the time, it's going to be limited to one anatomic site, and it's usually caused by systemic drug intake. 32 out of the 38 cases reported were associated with a systemic medication. 3 cases were associated with herbal products, and in 3 cases, the cause was unknown. The similar drugs, amoxicillin, clavulanic acid, amoxicillin, levofloxacin, cephalosporin, sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim, clindamycin, and piperacillin tazobactam were implicated, but also in anti-inflammatories like paracetamol, ibuprofen, allopurinol, even things like lamotrigine and infliximab. Importantly, finasteride was one of the cases reported, so one of the drugs that we prescribe with some frequency, and some of the herbal medications as well. And the presentation is really just localized AGEP, so very small, 2 to 1 millimeter pin-sized, non-follicular sterile pustules with an abrupt onset, usually within 2 to 4 days after contact with the triggering factor. A longer delay has been described, but it's usually less than 10 days. And mucosal involvement is rare. If it's present, it's typically mild. The patients don't usually have a whole lot of symptoms, but sometimes itching or burning sensation may be present. And just like what happens with AGEP, the patients will peel as if they had a sunburn 1 to 2 weeks after the medication is discontinued and the eruption begins to resolve. So the face is a common site of involvement, including as well also the trunk, upper limbs. Most patients with AGEP, the pustular eruption tends to be in intertriginous areas and then disseminates. So that's a typical feature of AGEP. The other symptoms, patients may have fever. That was noted in 10 cases. And lymphadenopathy was noted in 1 case. There are increased peripheral levels of Th17 cells, and IL-17 and IL-22 are reported to be present in increased quantities in AGEP. IL-17 and IL-22 can stimulate keratinocyte production of IL-8. And I always remember that IL-8 draws neutrophils because the 8 looks like a neutrophil nucleus. So if you remember, you know, the polymorphonuclear cells, they have those kind of twisted nuclei like little balloon animals. And so I always think that the 8 kind of reminds me of a nucleus for a neutrophil. And the neutrophils then can accumulate in the lesional dermis. IL-17 and IL-22 also have a synergistic effect on the CXC motive chemokine ligand 8, or the CXCL8, which is something that prevents also the apoptosis of neutrophils. And the CXCL8 is also a potent neutrophilic cytokine. It causes neutrophilic chemotaxis. into vesicles and then can cause the transformation of the vesicles into the sterile pustules. There is some thought that there may be a genetic basis for this condition, and some patients may have a genetic predisposition to developing their pustular mutations, specifically patients with a mutation in the IL-36 receptor antagonist, the IL-36RN, can have increased downstream production of inflammatory cytokines like IL-6, IL-8, IL-1 alpha, and IL-1 beta. So I think those things are important. The USCAR criteria for ALEP is kind of proposed here in this paper, which is localized numerous small clustered non-follicular pustules, background erythema, negative microbiology, acute onset less than 72 hours after medication, and resolution with post-pustular desquamation 14 days after discontinuing the medication. And then a nice tearaway for the residents on page, it's page 5 of 7 of the article. It's table 3 within the article. The differential diagnosis of ALEP includes, of course, bacterial folliculitis, but there's no involvement of the hair follicle with ALEP, dermatophytic infections, but of course we wouldn't have the circinate distributive pattern or the scale, viral infections such as VZV or HSV, but you might would have a negative PCR or zinc smear, impetigo, again, you'd have negative bacterial studies, and you wouldn't have the, I like this way they described it, meliceric crust, which is like a honey crust. Inflammatory diseases can simulate ALEP, contact derm, which can have pustules in it, especially with things like, I think it's dispersed blue can cause the pustular contact dermatitis. Pustular psoriasis can also mimic ALEP and AJEP. That's one of our chief differentials when we're looking at it under the microscope. IgA pemphigus or subcorneal pustulosis. This is something that wouldn't necessarily be associated with a specific drug and would typically have a pattern of recurring. Sweet syndrome is usually going to have a different clinical appearance. You know, pustules is an unusual presentation for sweet syndrome. Acne, of course, on the face, pustules on the face, your first thought might be acne. And remember, pustules on noses, think demodicosis. So facial demodicosis should also be in this differential. And then miliaria is going to have a sort of slightly different presentation. And of course, inducing events. You wouldn't have the telangiectasias that you would have in papulopustular rosacea necessarily if you were treating a patient with facial ALEP. So something for us to be aware of. And the differential, I think it's a very well-written article, and I appreciated them bringing it to light.
So weird. It's almost weirder than AJEP. I can kind of get behind there's something about your immune system that just wants to have neutrophils all over the place if it's triggered by some drug. But why would the neutrophils want to go just to one spot?
That is a very good question, and it's kind of confusing. Like, it is interesting that also a contact method has been proposed as well. And I think some patients have had repeat episodes with repeat stimulation. There's actually been case reports also of pustular contact dermatitis to fragrance, which is kind of cool.
And dispersed maybe yellow. I missed it, but what are we supposed to do if we see this? Steroids?
Stop the drug. And then you can treat it with topical steroid that helps mitigate the itch. I actually had a patient that had AJEP when I was in residency to an antibiotic that she had to be on because she had bacterial endocarditis, and that was the only antibiotic it was sensitive to. So we had to treat her through her AJEP. So my job as my derm consulting resident actually was to go to this woman every day and slather her with triamcinolone to kind of keep her pruritus under control so that she could stay on the medication and treat her infectious endocarditis. And she did fine. She actually survived her course of therapy. But it's a fascinating pathophysiology. And we still don't 100% understand why this happens.
Huh. Well, we don't have time for another article probably. So I'm just going to spend like 3 or 4 minutes to hit some other AAD highlights because why not?
I love it.
So went to some nail stuff. Onychomatrachoma. You look at the free margin of the nail plate with your dermatoscope, and you can see a, quote, honeycomb pattern.
I can actually put a picture of that up on Dermosphere, and you can highlight it with gentian violet.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, post that. An onychopapilloma has a similar appearance to an onychomatrachoma, but it starts in the lunula, and there's often a little fissure or nick at the free edge of the nail plate. Another quote about nails, always remove a pigmented band of the nail that appears in an adult, unless there's another good reason for it to be there. Do you remember we talked about BAPomas a long time ago, like maybe in the first episode of our podcast or something?
So long ago that the name has changed 3 times, I think, since then, yes. So Wiesner's nevi, BAPomas, now they're called, I think, BAP-impaired melanocytic tumors, which is better because BAPFOMA kind of implies that it expresses BAP, but it actually doesn't. And BAP is BRCA-associated protein 1. Go ahead.
I was reminded of them by one of these speakers. They look clinically like skin tags or intradermal nevi, but they're histologically distinct, and multiple BIMTs, BIMTs, are associated with these BAP1 germline mutations, which is a cancer syndrome, so helpful to know. This was a good one. So tranexamic acid, we've talked about it a couple times in the podcast, but maybe I should be using it more for melasma. It's a plasmin inhibitor. Melasma. Yeah, do you use it?
I do, yeah.
What dose do you use?
I use it topically and orally, and actually there is a commercial entity that provides an easier, cheaper, appropriate dose of tranexamic acid than I can get it compounded. So is it cool for me to say the commercial entity? I have no relationship with them at all.
Super cool.
Fabulous. Okay, it's called Musely, M-U-S-E-L-Y. And so one of the other, I think, nice things about that is if you've appropriately discussed with your patient the blood clotting risk and everything, the information that I give them is just, there's a company that makes a tranexamic acid supplement for melasma. This is the name of that company. And then they actually do the sort of e-prescribing and things, and it's still cheaper for the patient than I can get it through a compounding pharmacy. If anybody has a better source of the appropriate dose for a tranexamic acid for melasma, like if there's a compounding pharmacy where y'all can get it produced less expensively, I'd be very interested in hearing that. But that is something that's available commercially through Musely, which I don't have any personal relationship with at all.
The speaker mentioned it as well, that specific company, and also a study in 2021 that said people who otherwise are healthy with no other predisposing clotting risk don't really have a higher risk of thrombosis on the medicine. So you just want to make sure they don't have some clotting disorder. She also said that OCPs have a higher thromboembolic risk than tranexamic acid does, but you can get nausea, diarrhea, back pain. The dose in the trials was 250 milligrams twice a day, but it comes in 650 milligram tabs here. You could cut one in half and do 325 BID, which is a little overdosed, or maybe this Musely thing. Mm-hmm. The duration is unclear. So she said she treats for 3 months usually and then stops and kind of sees what happens. You can maybe do that like once a year or just if they need it, I suppose. And as long as we talked about compounding stuff, again, about hidradenitis suppurativa, resorcinol, 15% cream, has some little data behind it. This speaker said that a lot of her patients like it. She gets it pretty inexpensively from a compounding pharmacy called Smith Pharmacy in Little Chute, Wisconsin.
Very cool.
All right, that's probably all the time we have now, friends. So thanks for joining us today. Today, we learned about alternative therapies for warts and molluscum with Dr. Steve Louie. By the way, he's going to be at the Integrated Dermatology Symposium in September. So go join him. And Michelle, you'll be there too, apparently.
Yes, I will be.
We also learned a bunch of highlights from the AAD. We learned about benzoyl peroxide potentially breaking down into benzene, but hopefully not to a significant degree under normal circumstances. And we learned about acute localized exanthematous pustulosis. Thanks to all the members of Team Dermosphere who keep this moving along behind the scenes. They include Morgan Dykman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Laura Delic Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, Lee Orlaven, and Justin Lyon. Thanks also to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. If you would like to find more of our stuff, I can't blame you. You can do so on our website. It's called dermospherepodcast.com. It has links to all of the original articles that we talk about. It has our entire archive. It's also a good way to reach out and say hi. You can also do so via X, Instagram, and Facebook. If you would like to reach out, say hi, and also donate to the podcast, you are welcome to do so at uofuhealth.org/dermosphere. If you would like to see some of our content turned into video form, you can do that too, on YouTube and also on ViewMedi. And everyone is always welcome to join us at the University of Utah Dermatology Echo Sessions, which take place the second Friday of every month over the lunch hour. Friends, thanks again so much for hanging out with us, and we will see you in 2 weeks.